Hello there. Today is Wednesday, December 13th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a big U.S. Senate race with big implications for the country. We'll have a live report. The suspect in an attempted terror attack in New York City is officially charged.
He allegedly started to gather materials for his bomb two to three weeks ago.
World leaders at a climate summit in Paris criticized President Trump for leaving the agreement. Also ahead, a meteor shower is about to light up the sky around the world. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, we have some breaking news just coming in to the newsroom here in this big race in Alabama, the Senate race between Roy Moore, Republican Roy Moore, and Democrat Doug Jones. We have an upset in this state. We're going to go live right now to Alabama political reporter Chip Brownlee. Chip, what are you? This is quite unbelievable. What's going on? Did they just call the race?
Man, I wish you could see this crowd here right now. They are screaming. They're ecstatic. You know, they're crying. This is a big upset in Alabama for Republicans in Alabama right now. This is not at all anybody expected. Del Jones right now, actually, he is very excited. He's celebrating right now.
Did he actually come out? Has he talked yet?
He has not come out yet. He's actually in a high room, and I'm in a high room where I'm not supposed to be. So.
How big of a deal is it that a Democrat just won a Senate seat in this very, very Republican state of Alabama? Oh, well, we're having a hard time communicating with Chip. Are you with us? Well, it seems we have lost our connection, Chip. We will try to reconnect with him later on. But a big upset in the state of Alabama with a Democrat winning that state for the first time in a very long time, possibly decades. And it certainly does have big implications for voting in Washington on Capitol Hill and the Republican majority and, of course, the president's agenda. So, again, Alabama has elected a Democrat to the Senate for the first time in 25 years as Doug Jones defeats controversial Republican Roy Moore. Well, U.S. federal prosecutors have announced terrorism charges against Akayed Ullah on Tuesday, a day after the 27-year-old Bangladeshi immigrant allegedly detonated a pipe bomb in a New York City subway tunnel in what authorities say was an attack inspired by the Islamic State. June Kim, acting U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, announced the charges at a press conference in New York.
As he admitted in statements he made after being advised of and waiving his Miranda rights, Ullah admitted that he began researching how to build bombs about a year ago and had been planning this particular attack for several weeks.
Well, the charges included bombing a public place and using a weapon of mass destruction, each of which carries a maximum sentence of life in prison. Ullah is also charged with providing material support to IS, destruction of property by means of an explosive, and using a destructive device in furtherance of a crime of violence. These charges carry sentences of 5 to 30 years each. Turning now to the latest on social media, we're joined by VOA's Andrew Palchevsky. Andrew, what's happening?
Well, everybody is still talking about Akayed Ullah, who is the 27-year-old Bangladeshi immigrant, the suspect in that failed suicide bombing Monday in New York. And he tried to detonate that suicide vest, of course, at the Port Authority bus terminal in New York. The vest didn't fully detonate, and so only 4 people ended up being injured, avoiding catastrophe. But as we learn more about this case, Lori, we see that there are 2 connections to social media that have emerged. The first is that before he tried to carry out this attack, Ullah was on Facebook. Something that millions of people do every day. Of course, millions of people don't go out and try to commit terrorist attacks after they go on Facebook. But Ulla was on Facebook and he wrote, "Trump, you failed to protect your nation." And this ties into his alleged motive, which was that because President Trump last week declared Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, setting off protests around the world, that was part of the motivation for Ulla's attack. The second element of this is that Ulla also apparently started to become radicalized years ago after watching ISIS videos online. And of course, we've talked about how social media companies are trying to combat terrorist content on their networks. So while sadly this is another instance where people can access terrorist content online and use that to become radicalized, it's also an instance where social media is giving investigators some insight into why this suspect tried to carry out this attack. So social media plays a dual role in a lot of these cases, and I suspect that they're going to be doing a lot of digging into his social media accounts, not just Facebook, but if he has any other ones, to see what he's been saying, who he's been communicating with, and how he's been using them.
Absolutely. What else? What else is going on?
Well, yesterday we talked about Chamath Palihapitiya. And if our listeners don't remember that name, it's a pretty memorable name.
Yes,
but if they don't remember
is.
Who he is a former vice president for user growth at Facebook. And this week he said that social networks, including Facebook, are short-term dopamine-driven feedback loops where there's no civil discourse, no cooperation, just misinformation and mistruth. And he, of course, also said that social networks are ripping apart the social fabric of how society works. Pretty heavy words, especially from somebody who used to work at a social network. Well, we noted yesterday that Facebook hadn't weighed in on those comments, but on Tuesday they did. In a statement that was unusual, but on late Tuesday they did. In a statement that was unusual because it specifically addressed those comments, they usually don't target somebody specifically, it's more general statements. Facebook said that Chamath has not been at Facebook for over 6 years. When he was at Facebook, the company was focused on global growth, but now Facebook says that they've grown to more than 2 billion monthly active users, so their responsibilities have grown as well. They go on to say that they take their role very seriously and they've done a lot of research to understand the effects of Facebook and social media on the public, and they're investing in people, technology, and processes to make Facebook even better. So after not just this former vice president, but as we talked about yesterday, Sean Parker, one of the co-founders of Facebook, came out and said that he thought the network was destroying society and making children dumber and all these kind of things. I think Facebook finally saw enough and said we have to address these head on. And that's indeed what they've done.
All right, Andrew, thank you. You can follow him on Twitter at APOWL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. The U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is offering to begin talks with North Korea without preconditions. How will the U.S. push to cut U.N. peacekeeping budgets, and how will they affect soldiers? A new survey finds a majority in the U.S. believe government corruption has risen under Trump. And the U.S. airstrike hits an undetonated car bomb outside Mogadishu. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson Tuesday offered to begin talks with North Korea without preconditions while pointing to China to ramp up pressures against Pyongyang, including a complete oil embargo amid heightened tensions in the Korean Peninsula.
So we need the DPRK to come to the table for talks. We're ready to talk anytime they'd like to talk. But they have to come to the table, and they have to come to the table with a view that they do want to make a different choice.
VOA's Victor Beatty asks Stephen Norper, Senior Director at the Korea Society and Columbia University Adjunct Professor, how remarkable of a statement this is.
It's long overdue, and it's a remarkable step forward for negotiation for the United States to basically be in the position of saying that it's willing to come to the table and talk without those preconditions on North Korea means that negotiations much more likely. The prior situation, less so if it meant that they had to give that up as part of the precondition to come to the table. At this point, the United States is saying come and we'll talk from there.
He also mentioned that North Korea must show restraint. Quote, it's going to be tough to talk if in the middle of our talks, North Korea decides to test another device. So we continue to indicate to them that we need a period of quiet. You need to tell us you want to talk. North Korea has indicated it's not interested in talking, is it?
Well, North Korea has held off on some of its testing up until the November 29th test. There had been almost a 75-day hiatus, and so Washington is signaling that it wants to see a similar type of pause in missile and nuclear activity to show seriousness to get to the table to negotiate.
Interesting that Tillerson disclosed that the U.S. has been in discussions with China about how to secure North Korea's nuclear weapons in the event the government collapses. Is that extraordinary?
Well, I think what he's trying to do is signal a few things. He's saying that there's muscle behind the diplomacy. So he reiterated that the U.S. has military capabilities. He noted that there is the opportunity to step up sanctions even further, and he noted that there's been this conversation with China over the nuclear stockpile issue, and that the U.S. would, if it went forward, would then go back beyond the 38th parallel into South Korean territory to provide China some sort of security assurance. And all of that is designed to signal to North Korea that the U.S. is dealing with a portfolio of options, but it appears that negotiation now is certainly at the fore and a more realistic thing to be talking about today.
With regard to a dialogue without precondition, do you think President Trump backs that view?
I wouldn't be the person to answer that. Secretary Tillerson and President Trump are the only two people who know that answer, but one would assume with such a public address that Secretary Tillerson was going out and making an advance for negotiation, and one would assume that's coordinated with the White House.
When was the last time the U.S. and North Korea have actually sat down, either in a bilateral or multilateral setting? I know they've had back-channel communications in the interim.
Yeah, there have been back-channel communications, but there's been really no formal agreement since 2012 and the so-called Leap Day Accords. So it has been quite some time, and this would mark a dramatic new step forward. It certainly would scale back tensions, which is what this is designed to do. We're in a very dangerous state in terms of recent tensions, and the North Koreans have shown new and dramatic capability in terms of the November 29th test. So it behooves the entire international community to see North Korea and the United States sit down and try to resolve these issues.
All right, that's Stephen Norper, Senior Director at the Korea Society. Well, if you're a stargazer, you'll be happy to hear this. There will be a big sky show. Joining us now for more is NASA Jet Propulsion Lab Ambassador Greg Redfern. Greg, what can you tell us?
On the night of December 13th to the 14th, for people who are around the world, there is going to be the best meteor shower of the entire year called the Geminids. And this is a special meteor shower because it's one of the few that you can see meteors or shooting stars or falling stars all night long. Starts about 9 o'clock at night, goes all the way through to the next morning. And if your listeners are able to get out underneath a dark sky, they can see up to, it's predicted, anywhere from 100 to 120 an hour.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah.
If you got a good shot. And this is all over the world, not just here in the U.S.
This won't be like if you're deep in the southern hemisphere, mm-hmm. and you cannot see the constellation Gemini, mm-hmm. then you won't be able to see it. But that's a fairly small part of the world. But Gemini, the constellation, where all these shooting stars seem to come from, is visible, down to even like 25 south latitude. So it's pretty much a significant portion of the world.
Where are the best places in the world to see this?
Well, the best places would be anywhere that the constellation Gemini is above the horizon at about 9 o'clock. And this is basically the entire northern hemisphere. And as I said, a good chunk below the equator, too, down to about 25, 30 degrees south latitude. But the listener should try to concentrate in finding an area that's away from bright lights and has a nice view of the sky, because the more of the sky you see, the more meteors you can detect. And Gemini will be up in the east. That's true for everybody around the world. It'll be in the east. It rises about 9 o'clock, and it's visible all night. And these are going to be brighter than your normal shooting stars, at least some of them, because these little particles that are hitting the atmosphere at 22 miles a second are made of little rocky bits, the size of a grain of sand or maybe a pea. And the Geminids give us pretty good fireballs, which is anything brighter than the planet Venus. And it comes from a source called 3200 Phaethon, and it's a rock comet. And it goes around the sun every 1.4 years, and coincidentally this year, Lori, that rock comet, 3200 Phaethon, will pass by the Earth December 16th, the closest it's been since it was discovered back in 1983. So this shower, the Geminids, is getting better and better every year as this rock comet dumps more and more material. And if it's cloudy where people are, or if they can't really see Gemini, they can tune in to NASA.gov as their meteoroid office will be carrying live on Facebook via U.S. stream from 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time all the way through sunrise on December 14th. So even if you can't see it or it's cloudy, tune in to NASA and enjoy the show.
All right. That's NASA Jet Propulsion Lab Ambassador Greg Redfern. Thanks so much. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hey there, this is Shauna Renee, the lady DJ and host of Soul Lounge. Every Sunday at 1400 UTC, I choose an artist that you and I love, and we break down their entire career while listening to their biggest hits. That's what we do here on the Soul Lounge. Once again, every Sunday, 1400 UTC, right here.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.
VOA's International Edition continues now with Hollywood news. For that, we're joined by Rare.us content editor Nicole Moschella. Hi, Nicole. So these horrific wildfires in Southern California now impacting lots of people, not just ordinary people, celebrities too, including a beloved comedian.
Yeah, this week, Ellen DeGeneres and her wife, Portia Del Rossi, had to evacuate their California home. Like you said, these fires are just ripping through the Los Angeles area, and they were in a burning zone, so they left. They packed up their pets, and they got out of there. Ellen tweeted the news early Monday and said, "Our house is under threat of being burned. We evacuated with our pets. I'm praying for our community and thankful for the incredible firefighters." There is no word on where she might have gone she and her wife might have gone to escape these fires. But other celebrities are also urging residents in California to take notice and maybe grab pets or grab stray animals as they see them. There's a really viral video of a man saving a rabbit from the brush fire. So I think people are really banding together. They're being serious about this. And Ellen tweeted again today, Tuesday, and said that she thanked the firefighters again for being brave and helping save their community. And hopefully everything will be okay with her and her home and everybody out there in California.
Yeah, it's just a horrifically sad and upsetting situation, and really seems to be just getting worse and worse every year. And then we've got all the celebrity news today is not on the fun side, I guess you could say. You know, more and more of this sort of movement that's happening here in the United States, where women are coming forward talking about men either saying or doing something inappropriate, and now apparently we hear of another very well-known figure.
We've heard a lot of these stories about powerful men in Hollywood who have been facing these sexual misconduct allegations, and Larry King is the latest one to join that ever-growing list. Terry Richard the ex-wife of Eddie Fisher, came forward this week in an interview with the Daily Mail where she said there were two separate occasions, one in 2005 and one in 2006, where she alleged that Larry King groped her. She said that during a photo op, he touched her buttocks twice on these two separate occasions. And she said that she claimed that he would do it in front of the camera because she couldn't have a reaction. She couldn't say anything. So after these allegations about him came forward, his attorneys did deny all of the allegations and said that they intend to file a lawsuit for defamation. That's really all he said. He's speaking through his attorneys at this time. So we'll have to see. Maybe, I don't know if maybe more women will come forward, if he really will file this lawsuit, or what's going to happen. But it's just like another day, another crazy story like this coming out of Hollywood.
And you got that right. That's Rare.us content editor Nicole Michella. Thanks for being with us. Singer Ed Sheeran got a superstar to join him in a remix of his song Perfect, and the recording is topping the charts. VOA's Border Crossing host Larry London joins International Edition's Sarah Williams with the latest.
What makes this particular song so interesting? Ed contacted Beyoncé. He didn't expect her to say, yes, I'll do the song with you, but it's Ed's latest release, and we're going to listen to the Ed Sheeran-Beyoncé collaboration, which is called Perfect, here on International Edition.
Well, I found a man stronger than anyone I know. He shares my dreams. I hope that someday we'll share our home. I found love to carry more than just my secrets, to carry love, to carry children of our own.
Yes, he had a pretty big hit, I think, earlier this year.
Yeah, it was doing very well, and he had his fingers crossed for hoping for a number one song. But he needed the star power of a Beyoncé to pick it up to number one, which it is. It is the week's new number one song. It has just knocked Post Malone, rock star, off the top, which spent 8 weeks at number one. So Ed Sheeran has a new number one song, and it's called Perfect. Although Ed Sheeran didn't get the Grammy nominations everybody expected him to get. He only got two Grammy nominations. Jay-Z was the big Grammy nominee for the night with eight. But Ed is up for two. So Ed's album is Divide, and it was also revealed by Ed recently that he didn't get hit by a car while riding a bike. He was actually a little bit tipsy. He had gone to the pub and had a few too many and went down a hill on his bike, and it was widely reported that he was hit by a car. He said, no, it was just me being very careless. And he said, I promise to always wear a helmet when I bike in the future. But his arm and his hand have healed, and now he's back out on tour. He's going to continue to tour for the foreseeable future. The album is Divide. It's doing so well for him. He's had such a huge year. The most streamed song of the year, Shape of You, and his album Divide, the most streamed album of the entire year. So Ed is finishing strong, and a lot of people are just mystified. What is the allure or the attraction to Ed Sheeran? He's not particularly handsome. What is it about Ed Sheeran? Well, he writes great songs, and he's written for so many artists, and he's one of the most in-demand songwriters right now. Everybody wants to work with Ed Sheeran. Speaking of which, he said he sent an email to Beyoncé, and it was not easy to find her because she changes her email address every week.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
And so he sent it, and she did write back and say, I'll do it. And then he said he was even more impressed with her saying, how about if we do this, and how about if we try that? And so he loved it, and, you know, the song speaks for itself. It's now number one.
Yeah, and I believe I saw him just recently on the Internet, a picture of him performing with Taylor Swift.
Yeah, he's, you know, very good friends with Taylor Swift, and he likes to run his music by Taylor, and she runs her music by him. It's just a matter of time before the two of them actually collaborate on a song. I can't figure out why that hasn't happened yet, but they are best friends. And she has nothing but love for him, and he in kind has nothing but love for her. So, yeah, they do hang out. They were at the Jingle Ball concert together. That's probably where you saw them on the Internet. They both performed in New York City. By the way, speaking of the Jingle Ball, here's a shameless plug for my show, Border Crossings. I was at the D.C. Jingle Ball this week, and I caught up with Camila Cabello, and she's got a new song out as well. And maybe we'll do that on next week's International Edition. And I also spoke with Julia Michaels, who's nominated for several Grammys. And it's interesting because she put out her first CD in 2010. She's got her third CD out now called Nervous System. And she's in the Best New Artist category.
Wow.
Even though she's been doing this for about 6 years. She was lovely to talk to. And I've also got an interview with a boy band called Why Don't We? That's the name of the group, Why Don't We? And so you'll hear those interviews coming up on Border Crossings.
All right. Thanks a lot, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings.
Baby, I'm dancing in the dark with you between my arms, barefoot on the grass.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music.
Wake up, dance this music.
Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Dave Magnus. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have yourself a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Excess and loosely secured weapons and munitions worldwide pose a security risk and humanitarian threat through illicit diversion to terrorists, insurgents, and other destabilizing actors. Landmines, unexploded ordnance, and other explosive remnants of war not only kill and maim thousands of people every year, they stand in the way of post-conflict stabilization and reconstruction and inhibit long-term development. The United States is committed to making post-conflict communities safer, thus saving lives, preventing injuries, and allowing displaced peoples to return to their homes, which enables faster economic recovery and development. To highlight U.S. government efforts in this area, the State Department's Office of Weapons Removal and Abatement issues a yearly report entitled To Walk the Earth in Safety. The most recent edition, released on December 12th, documents how the United States has invested more than $2.9 billion since 1993 for the securing and safe disposal of excess small arms, light weapons, and munitions, as well as the safe clearance of landmines and explosive remnants of war in more than 100 countries. This investment makes the United States the world's single largest financial supporter of conventional weapons destruction. Many of these programs not only clear landmines and unexploded ordnance, they also help to educate communities, especially children, on how to prevent injuries and death from landmines and explosive remnants of war, and create jobs that can provide a boost to post-conflict recovery efforts. Conventional weapons destruction is a complicated process that requires broad international cooperation. Therefore, the State Department, the Department of Defense, the U.S. Agency for International Development, and other U.S. government agencies all work together with foreign governments, non-governmental organizations, and private companies to reduce conventional weapons and munitions stockpiles, improve security at storage sites, and implement humanitarian mine action programs. In her introduction to the report, Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Political Military Affairs, Tina Kaidenow, noted that support for conventional weapons destruction is a cornerstone of our national security policy. and stressed that the success of our program is built on strong bipartisan support from Congress and the people of the United States, who recognize that our nation benefits from helping to create a world in which all may walk the earth in safety.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.